Let me add tonight to the list of the sick, Kevin Lee, who is struggling with pneumonia at home where he's being treated. We just celebrated more than 200 years of independence as a nation on July the 4th. Calls to mind the words of Patrick Henry to the Virginia House of Burgesses on the occasion of the convention in 1775, when he asked the question, is life so precious and peace so dear that it must be purchased at the price of change and slavery? I know not what other men may choose, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death. That has been the cry of the American spirit. We celebrate in our national anthem that we are the land of the free and the home of the brave. 100 years ago, in Colorado Springs, Colorado, Catherine Lee Bates wrote the words of the song that some think ought to be the national anthem, America the Beautiful. She was a professor at Wellesley College in Boston, Massachusetts, and had traveled across the country through the city of Chicago, where the World's Fair was going on, and across the plains, and finally into Colorado in the shadow of Pikes Peak. And there she wrote the familiar words, America the Beautiful. Oh, beautiful for spacious skies, for amber ways of grain, for purple mountain majesties above thy fruited plain. America, America, God shed his grace on thee. Crown thy good with brotherhood from sea to shining sea. But what we do not know are the other two verses that are between that one and the last one, O beautiful for patriot dream, that sees beyond the years, whose alabaster cities gleam undimmed by human tears. These verses, O beautiful for pilgrim feet, whose stern, impassioned stress, a thoroughfare for freedom beat across the wilderness. America, America, God, mend thine every flaw. Confirm thy soul in self-control, thy liberty in law. O beautiful for heroes proved in liberating strife, who more than self their country loved, and mercy more than life. America, America, may God thy gold refine, till all success be nobleness and every gain divine. Perhaps the reason those two interior verses have not lived in our country is because they speak of truths that we have lost. I want to speak with you tonight about freedom. But I want to remind you that the freedom that our ancient forebears sought when they came to this country was not a freedom from merely, but a freedom to. They had a dream and a vision that is evident in that 100-year-old song, that we were made free to achieve something that would bring honor and glory to the human race as it obeyed and sought to persevere in things that had to do with God. Unashamed of that kind of aspiration, they wrote about it. This generation knows very little of that. Peter Kraft, who is a professor of philosophy at Boston College, in a book published in 1990 called Making Choices, said the naive optimism of the 60s is dying because our civilization is dying. To that voice is the voice of Carl F. H. Henry, who is a well-known evangelistic theologian, or evangelical theologian, who wrote of the twilight of our culture. Malcolm Muggeridge, the irascible English journalist, who has had a late in life conversion of some sorts to spiritual things, predicted the end of Christendom, that is, the influence of the gospel in our culture. Alistair MacIntyre refers to the New Dark Ages. Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who was the Russian author who came to this country seeking refuge from the Soviet Union, warned the West soon after he got here about the debilitating spiritual exhaustion of this country and the whole of the West. Charles Colson, who was imprisoned in the time the Watergate scandal, warns of the new barbarians who have no higher law than self-interest. These are bad times. I don't think anyone can controvert that. Civilization in this country is dying. And it's dying because the family is dying. This illustration, I think, will be helpful. High school principals surveyed in 1958 about the main problems with their students listed these five things. 1, not doing homework. 2, not respecting property, that is, throwing books. 3, leaving lights on and doors and windows open. 4, throwing spitballs in class. 5, running through the halls. 1988, 30 years, one generation later, not the same principles, but a group of principles surveyed at the same question listed these: number 1, abortion; number 2, AIDS; number 3, rape; number 4, drugs; number 5, fear of violent death, murder, and guns and knives in school. That's where we are tonight. Marriages are collapsing in this country at the rate of 1 in 2. Ann Landers sent a questionnaire to her column readers, to those that were married, and asked this question: if you had it to do over again, would you marry your spouse? 75% said no. The children in this country face a very long shot at happiness. When perhaps 1 in 4 to 1 in 7 or 8 have a chance of living in a home where you find trust, love, security, or happiness, what kind of society can be built on that? It utterly is impossible to build a society when the basic building block of all society is collapsing. Fidelity inside and chastity outside of marriage is no longer the norm in this country. The majority of teenagers have lost their virginity, and some of them do not even know what it is. Ask your children. They can tell you what's going on in the world in which they live. A sexuality that is driven, filled with great passion, but characterized by no moral strictures and no restraint. Secondly, the civilization that we live in, and particularly our American culture, is dying because of greed, pure and simple, and selfishness. Have you heard any political candidates recently appeal to their constituency on the basis of courage, or virtue, or goodness, or unselfishness? Every politician in this country knows that people vote their pocketbook, that if you're going to be elected, you've got to talk about things. You've got to talk about better jobs. You've got to talk about more pay. And the great tragedy of leaving our children with less financially than we ourselves had, that, of course, would be the absolute betrayal of the American dream. If the American dream is more money for more people for all the succeeding future days, then that's not a dream, it's a nightmare. Obviously, if we're going to judge our success with people on the basis of whether or not we've collected more than those who went before us, then we have some grievous times ahead. Jesus talked more about greed and about the awesome failure to use money properly than perhaps any other thing except the kingdom of God itself. And he warned us about it. Greed destroys the soul. It will eat out the spiritual energy of every last one of us. And we don't have any heroes in this society. I've thought about that recently, and it's been called to my attention. No heroes. What do you think when the heroes of a society become rock stars? These mindless shouters of imperceptible lyrics who grind away in loud cacophony, and these are the heroes of the society? And if it's not rock stars, it's basketball players who've had so many lovers that they don't know where they got the disease. This is what we're left with in a society that has no moral models, has no men of courage and virtue, women of courage and virtue that have caught the imagination of the society. We expect the politicians to be corrupt. The FBI has been down in Frankfurt until they've rooted out so many people, we're waiting for the next shoe to fall. We expect it. We expect it because it's gotten to be the normal thing. The medical profession, even, that once was respected as a group of servants of the society who would travel out to sick people's houses and do what they could to help people that were in distress, are now looked upon as a greedy group of people who are just trying to drain the American population of the last dime they can get for their expensive medical treatments, which will keep them in the level of life to which they have become accustomed. Lawyers are viewed as shysters. We hear often it said in this society the last thing we need is one more attorney. The most litigious society in human history, religious figures are looked on as frauds. This is the land of Jim and Tammy Baker, the land of Jimmy Swaggart, and even John F. Kennedy and Martin Luther King, who have been adored by many in this society, have been proven to be adulterers and womanizers who lied to their mates about their activity. The century began with much hope. We looked for the end of war, poverty, ignorance, and yet this century is the one that invented the world war. And we've had 2 of them, and we're afraid of the 3rd. This century has been noted for its brutal atrocities. About 100 million people have been slaughtered for one reason or another. One child visionary of India is said to have revealed that the devil asked God for one century for his own, and he gave him the 20th. And that seems to make a lot of sense. We have lost our vision of true, absolute moral values in this country. There are bad times. But I hope that I don't make you think that for all the bad things that surround us, that these are bad times for good men, because I think bad times are made for good men. I like the words of Sir Thomas More: the times are never so bad that a good man cannot live in them. Put that down. The times are never so bad that a good man cannot live in them. Bad times are made for good men. It's in bad times that good men and good women are so desperately needed. We are needed in this generation. As desperately as ever Christians have been needed, we're needed now. Paul says in Philippians 2, 14 to 15, do all things without murmurings and complainings, that you may become blameless and harmless, the children of God in the midst of a perverse and crooked generation, holding forth, or seen as lights in the world, holding forth the word of life. The darker the society, the more brightly we will shine as we seek to serve the Lord. And we need to be doing that. The essence of goodness, of moral virtue, is what Jesus has taught us, and that is unselfishness. We addressed that this morning. Unselfishness. And the reason this society is falling to pieces is because there's so much selfishness. There's no sense of loving country more than life, or more than self, and mercy more than life. Why, those words don't have meaning in these times. Catherine Bates wrote them a long time ago when there would have been a responding echo in other citizens in this country. But now there's nothing. All we've got is the purple mountain majesties and the waves of grain, and the earnest passion to find some more of this world's goods, and the deep disenchantment with the fact that I haven't gotten it. Unselfishness. Good parents. What are good parents? They are parents who rear their children unselfishly, out of concern for their children, because they want their children to be good, who will sacrifice themselves in order to produce in this world a godly child, honorable and honest, courageous and virtuous, trustworthy in every way. And even when the vision is something less than the spiritual vision that God has given us in Christ, there's something noble about it. And that's what Catherine Bates said 100 years ago, that all success be nobleness. And what we want today is success, no matter whether it's noble or not. If we have to rob other people, the cheating on the stock market, if we have to leave people in shambles financially as a consequence of having robbed them of their life savings, that's just the game. That's what it's about. We have to try to achieve, no matter the cost for others. No nobleness. A loss of a sense of nobility. I want to say to the young people in this audience, and the older people as well, we need to get a vision of noble, unselfish self-sacrifice. Because otherwise, we're going to be poor specimens of the human race, so wrapped up in ourselves that we'll make a very small package indeed. What makes good friends? Friends who seek the good of each other, and no matter what the cost. What makes good lovers? Those that forget themselves and the joy of serving the other. And that's what Jesus said. He said, subject yourselves one to another in the fear of Christ, Ephesians 5:21. Which is another way of saying, serve one another. The words of Galatians chapter 5, verse 13, or verse 23, I believe, that's verse 13, are these: that we were called for freedom. Only use not your freedom as an occasion to the flesh, but rather in love serve one another. That's the secret of true nobility. It's the secret of true greatness. It's the secret of virtue, courage, the secret of the meaningful life. And so I urge upon you that you seek with all that's in you to escape from this selfish mentality that says, I've got to have my part of this pie. I've got to be somebody in such a way that other people are going to recognize that I've achieved something at the material level. Forsake that dream. It is not a dream. It's a nightmare. And it's going to result, as we said this morning, in some horrible things. What is the answer to the problem? Well, The answer to the problem is to accept the freedom that we have been given in a responsible, godly way. I want to talk to you about two kinds of freedom here. God has made us free. The existentialist, Sartre, French existentialist, made this statement. We are condemned to freedom. Now, for Sartre, it was a heavy burden. Sartre did not believe in God. He didn't believe in any purpose in the universe. And yet he felt himself free to make all these choices. And the only way that he could become significant was just to exercise that freedom. I want to tell you, we're not condemned to freedom, but we are made for freedom. That's what Paul said. We are free. God made human beings so that when we make decisions, they are free choices. And it can create some horrible consequences, I have to tell you. Because sin is a product of freedom. Rebellion against God is a product of freedom. Adultery is a product of freedom. Deception is a product of freedom. Lying is a product of freedom. Because sin is lawlessness. 1 John 3, verse 4. Sin is lawlessness. It is a rejection of the law of God. And we have that capacity. But if you think that's bad, you remember this fact, that if sin is a product of freedom, so also is love. There can't be any love unless there's freedom. There can't be any goodness unless there's freedom. Because what we are compelled to is not sin, because we're not responsible for what we have to do. And if we have to do it, it's not virtue either, because I should get no credit for what I had to do anyway, being myself. No choice in the matter. We are free. We are significant beings. And that's the reason that the possibility of sin has opened up in our lives. Now, I want to talk with you about the basic fundamental nature of sin. Sin, in the final analysis, grows out of a resistance of some part of God's will. And behind every one of these statutes, these requests, these commandments, is the righteous God. I'll use it. There's only one point in this thing that really attracts us. It may be because we want to be selfish in use of our money. That's the problem. Maybe we're willing very much to be religious in some fashion or other, but we've got a problem with money. A lot of people have had problems with money. Remember the rich farmer Jesus has told us about in the parable of that man who said, I'll tear down my barns, build bigger barns. The last thought in his mind was trying to be helpful to somebody else because he's been blessed with it. And we're just like the rich farmer, because every time we get an increase in salary, every time we get some inheritance, what's the first thing we think about? We think about, oh my, now look what we're going to be able to do for ourselves. They're trying to find this fellow who's got $111 million now, so they can ask him what he's going to do with the money, what kind of car he's going to buy, what kind of new house he's going to buy, if he's going to quit work, what he's going to do for himself. Because it's in those terms that we so often think. And God said, this night is your soul required of you, and then who shall these things be? What a fool. But I want you to remember that it's not just a problem with money that the man has. His problem is with God. He's a rebel against God. He can be just fine when it comes to marital fidelity. He can be as straight as an arrow when it comes to telling the truth. He can be honorable in his work. His farming can be an expression of absolute solid integrity, and still he's an ungodly rebel against God, because when it came to obeying the Lord with regard to things, he doesn't want to do that. Sometimes it may be the problem of sexuality. Willing to go to church, willing to preach the gospel, willing to do all kinds of things, but I'm not going to keep myself in the right bed, and I'm not going to keep myself pure and chaste with regard to the opposite sex, because I have a drive in that direction. Other people just have to remember, Jimmy Swaggart, case in point, blasting everybody from the pulpit down in Baton Rouge, talking about the ungodly and worldly people in the world, excoriating them in ways that I thought were absolutely powerful, but all the while running down to the streets of Baton Rouge in some dark street corner to cohabitate with prostitutes. It can happen to anybody. Now, the point of it all is that it's not just one little narrow area that man had problem with. He had problem in his relationship with God altogether, because it was at this point that he was unwilling to yield to the will of God. It's not just one commandment out of 10 or one commandment out of 100 that he's disturbed and violated. He has violated his responsibility to God. Sin is a product of pride and rebellion. That's exactly what Genesis tells us in Genesis 3. The serpent said to Eve, God knows in the day that you eat thereof, you shall be as God, knowing good and evil. And she bought that. And we are still buying it. We're buying the lie that God put us in this world to make us miserable. That doesn't care a thing in the world about us, that what He does is dangle before our longing eyes the only thing that really is valuable. He lets us have all the trash for ourselves. We can eat every tree in the garden. We can have all this. But the one thing that's truly valuable, He says, no, you can't touch it. I tell you, if you can believe a lie like that, you can believe anything. I can sell you the Brooklyn Bridge. That God doesn't care, has no interest in us. Is that what the world tells you? Is that what you see about you? A declaration that God is indifferent, that God does not care, He's made no provision? Think about it. For every need of the human being, not only the human body, but the human spirit, there is an answer. But she believed that. And she was therefore deceived, and therefore sinned, and it was because of the desire to be free, to be as God, to exercise that freedom, to be free from God. Do you have that desire? I want you to be honest with yourself now tonight. Why are you not a Christian? Some of us in this audience are not Christians. We've heard enough gospel to convert the whole of the continent of Africa. And I say that as kind as I know how. But people have continued to love you and to be patient with you as they teach. And you've had this opportunity. And you need to ask yourself the question just as honestly as you can. Why am I not a Christian? Is it because I do not believe these things? That I militantly deny them? No, it's not. I don't believe it. I believe you would affirm them to be true. I believe you believe them to be true. I'm going to tell you what the problem is. I'm going to tell you what the problem is because it's not just your problem. It's the problem of all of us. You want to be free from God. You're not yet willing to yield to Him. It's not just one or two of these commandments that's giving you difficulty. It's not because you have to lie every now and then in order to have your life like you want it. It's because you do not want to be subject to God. That's where the crisis is. That's the reason the second chapter of James says to offend in one part of the law is to be guilty of all, because behind every command is God. It's with God we're dealing. Sin is rebellion. It is refusal to do the will of God. That's using your freedom that God has given you in His grace to spit in His face and tell Him you're not going to do what He says. You say, I've never done that. I know you haven't. I have made it dramatic in order to help you understand that it doesn't make any difference how sweetly you say to God, I will not do your will. Or how sweetly you say, one of these days I'm going to do your will. The upshot of it is, you're not going to do it. And tomorrow never comes. And today is reality, and today is life, and what's not done today is not done at all, and no need making all these promises in order to keep an aching conscience from aching more, because it will avail nothing. Now is the time we have to make these decisions. It's the time I have to make these decisions about my own spiritual life. Sin is rebellion against God. It's the exercise of freedom to be wicked, to be selfish, to be lust-filled, to be dishonest, and whatever else the devil has tempted us to get into. That's one kind of freedom. You can use it. But I want to remind you of something while you're thinking about that kind of freedom. That sin began as an attitude. And that attitude is one of pride and rebellion. And then it's expressed in an act. But you want to see the attitude behind the act. The most important question is not what did you do, but the question is why did you do it? Why are you doing it? Why do you continue to do it? But that's not the whole story. We all think that we have this attitude problem, of course. And we would deny we have an attitude problem. We just said we just did that thing. That one thing. And I don't do that too often. It's every now and then I do that. I don't do it all the time. The question is, why do you do it at all? An attitude problem is here because you have never said to the Lord, I will do your will. You will be the Lord of my life. You have never said that. And that's the one thing He wants you to do. He does not expect perfection. Some of us sitting out there saying, well, I just can't be that. Well, can you be honest? Can you sincerely say, I want to serve the Lord and I will do my best to do that? He never asked for more. The Lord has never asked for more than that. In all His love and grace toward us, He never wanted more than that. So the excuse that, well, I can't get it all together, I couldn't be perfect. Well, we know that already. That's what grace is about, that's what the gospel is about. But this attitude that's sitting behind this act is what's critical. But what you want to take note of is the fact that these acts are finally going to issue in an addiction. In fact, the book of Romans talks about slavery to sin. That's exactly what the Lord said in John chapter 8, verse 31 and 32. You are my disciples indeed, if you abide in my word. And you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. And verse 36, if the Son shall make you free, you shall be free indeed. But between those two verses, 31, 32, and 36, this statement is made when these Jews reject his statement that they need to be freed because they've never been in bondage to any man. He said, the man that practices sin is a slave of sin. This attitude, which issues in acts, will become an addiction until it binds you down. You started out wanting to be free to sin, and that's all you can do. Because you've taught yourself well how to be selfish and taught yourself well how to entertain certain lusts and desires that at last are going to become bitter. Remember the prodigal son. He wanted his freedom. Give me that which is due to me, he said. You give it to me. I want freedom, but I do not want the freedom to stay here in this house. I want freedom to go to the far country. I want freedom not to be with you, not to do your will, not to be in this house. And he got down there and he got a good taste of it. Let me tell you, sin has its own reward. It brings all kinds of misery and sorrow and suffering that's a part of itself. Augustine said, the punishment for sin is sin. And what that simply means is that when you run against what you're made for, when you do what is contrary to your own nature because you are made in the image of God and therefore your nature is spiritual just exactly as His nature is, and when you do the things that are contrary to that, you're just going to tear up the machine. Tear up your conscience. Tear up your character. As a consequence of the contradiction that's going to exist inside your personality, you're going to know some miserable moments. You know, you can be miserable because of the heat. We've been miserable because of the heat here lately. We complain about the heat. We can be miserable because of other kind of weather circumstances that are not too pleasant. We can be miserable because our job happens to be at this particular moment burdensome. We can be miserable because a boss has been unconscionably demanding. We can be miserable because this thing or that thing has happened. But I want to tell you about what is true, essential, quintessential misery. That's when deep within yourself, you are wretched because you know what you are and you hate yourself for it. I mean, that's pain. I've often felt that that's going to be the pain of hell. The pain of knowing that you are separated from God and you did it to yourself. And you went on stubbornly resisting every appeal to change, and you put yourself right in the fires of hell. You put yourself there by stubborn refusal to accept all the goodness and grace of God. I would think that that would be a wretched end. There is psychic pain. There is the pain of guilt. There's a pain and misery of wanting to be free from what you chose to do. And you choose to rebel against God, and you will choose to sin against Him. But at last, there will be an addictive quality to that sinful state. I don't mean you can't come out of it. But I'm telling you, God alone can take you out and make you free. That's what the Lord said. If the Son shall make you free, you shall be free indeed. Free from what? Free from sin. But we want to be free to sin. That's one of the death-dealing deceptions of the devil, and that is that if he can get us to believe that all freedom is the freedom to do what's wrong, not the freedom to do right, who would imagine that Adam and Eve would dream the dream in the Garden of Eden that the great freedom here is to please God. To do what He made us for. To enjoy the good things that He has given and said, you may have all these things. To obey Him, to serve Him, to honor Him, to glorify Him. That is freedom to us. Because freedom to us has to be something that we choose for ourselves when we exercise our own stubborn determination to have our way. But I want to say to you, the other kind of freedom is the freedom to do His will and the freedom to serve His way. And that's true freedom because that's running the train on the tracks and driving the car on the road. It's mindless to decide that what I want to do is drive over here in the stumps. I won't drive on that highway. That's somebody else's idea. Put that stripe down the middle of the pavement and expect us all to drive there. I won't drive out here in the ditch. Well, drive in the ditch until you tear the thing up, until there's nothing left to drive. Until you're walking, until you've walked yourself down, until you can't even walk anymore. That is a metaphor for what happens to us spiritually. Look at these burnt-out hulks, morally and spiritually in the world. You think they're happy? They're miserable. And they're miserable because they're not what God wants them to be. And sometimes there is this thought within their hearts, I am sure many times this thought within their hearts, I just wish I could be good again. Just wish I could be righteous again. I just wish I could be pure again. I just wish I had my life to live over. Well, the fortunate thing in Christ is you have that privilege. You've got a chance to live it over, to start over again, and to be something different simply because God in His love and mercy makes it possible. Not just forgiveness, but a love so important and so powerful coming out of Him that it can motivate you to do what you couldn't do by yourself. The freedom not to sin. The freedom to be good. The young man that went away saying, give me what's coming to me, came back saying what? Father, make me one of your hired servants. I just love the privilege of working for you. Even if I'm not your son anymore. I just want to be here. I just want to be near you. I just want to be near this house. You have no idea. I have no idea as I need to. What a heritage we have with God, who is inviting us not to come and be His robots, not to come and be His mindless slaves, not to come and be His tools, but to be His children. And that's freedom. The freedom from sin, but not just freedom from sin, the freedom to righteousness, the freedom to goodness, freedom to love, the freedom to selflessness. And the reason that's freedom is because all those attitudes and dispositions of heart are exactly what God made us for, and things run right when we do it. Our conscience is at peace within ourselves. Our relationship with other people begin to mend in the wonderful truth that by loving other people, they are changed. Even when they're not lovable, we love them anyway. In being fair and righteous and honest in all our dealings, telling the truth. So real freedom begins when we take responsibility for the mess we've made and ask God to forgive us because He said, I will forgive you, and begin the new life. We have to choose between those freedoms. Both of them are freedoms of sort. The freedom of hell and the freedom of heaven, I guess we can call it. And we have to choose. I'm urging you. That's the reason for this lesson. I'm urging you to choose the freedom to serve God. Because He's made that possible. And we're going to be singing this hymn, God Receiveth Sinful Men. Isn't that remarkable? This sinless God, this wonderful God, this holy God, this righteous God receives. And may I say to you that the receive word, as it's used in Romans 14 and 15, which tells us to receive one another, and then says, as Christ has received us, that word for receive means intensive reception. It means to receive one to your heart. God receives us to His heart, not at arm's length. Not saying, well, I'll let you in here, but I want you to know that I'm watching you with a very careful eye. Maybe you'll make it, maybe you won't. Mark Largent said he'd be glad when he gets off his 90-day probation period at Ford Motor Company. I want to tell you something. Ford Motor Company does that, but the Lord never does. He never brings you in and says you're on probation till. You are in. You are forgiven. You are His child. All the privileges of that position are yours from the beginning. And I want to tell you something. The fact that He's loved us like that changes us. Enables us to be loving too. Moves us to be righteous too and to grow in that righteousness. What a privilege. Free to be truly free. And only the Son can do that. Only the Son of God can achieve that. And it'll be a tragedy if you let that slip past you and live your life in slavery to sin. Because I want to say what Paul said about that. The 6th chapter of Romans, he said, what kind of wages did you get out of that work you've done for sin? You've been working for the devil all this time. What do you got? What do you got for your trouble? And then he adds, but the free gift of God. The wages of sin. What you'll work for and struggle for is death. But the free gift of God is eternal life. Let freedom ring. True freedom. When Martin Luther King, in his great oration in the city of Washington, said, in the language of that old Negro spiritual. Free at last. Free at last. Thank God Almighty. Free at last. He was speaking about political freedom. That's not much. Because people can be free as the Lord makes you free, whether there's political freedom or not. That may be helpful, but it's not essential to what we are to be in this life. Therefore, let me say again, let us in these dark times shine as lights. It is a time for good men. It is a time for virtuous women. It is a time for courageous men and women. It is a time for godly men and women to shine in this dark world. And in that shining, in that light that they bring, think about the changes you can make in the lives of others. People need you out there. Be sure you've got the light shining and that you're living your life in the true freedom of Christ. If you're not a Christian, come and confess the Lord now while we're standing and singing this hymn to encourage you.